Jane is feeling restless. Meanwhile, unbeknownst to her, there is a woman locked away in a singular room who's surely more trapped and restless than Jane can ever mm-hmm. imagine.
Adele and Mrs. Fairfax are the two main pillars of Thornfield that Rochester brought here to care for.
Yeah.
Adele is a child who maybe isn't his and was abandoned by her mother. And Mrs. Fairfax is a widow with no real claim to be there. And he makes sure that they both have a good life.
Lillian, hello. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am kind of on pins and needles right now because we read the next section of Jane Eyre and I read through it so quickly that I texted you and I was like, hey, can we like record soon? Because I want to go on to the next chunk. And you're like, oh boy, okay.
As we've sort of established the last time we talked about the books, I read more often than Piper. So I was anticipating needing to pace myself so that I didn't like read ahead and be pushing her to read. Like I didn't want to be pushing her. And then I get a text and she's like, I'm on the last chapter of this section. I'm like, oh my God, it's been 3 days. So
one of those days was a holiday. So I had a lot of time to just sit in bed and read this book. And yeah, reading Rochester scenes is a really good motivation for me to keep reading. So I'm like, oh my gosh, I need more. I really need more. But before we get too into it, we have to talk about these chapters. And I'm so excited to do so.
Yes. So we today are talking about chapters.
I think it was chapter 11 through 14. I believe that's what we read.
Yes. So not a ton of chapters, but a lot of stuff happens in it and a lot of stuff that you and I really want to talk about in depth. So I'm excited. Yes. Most notably, we left Jane as she had just turned 18 by skipping 8 years. She'd gotten a new job with this lady and she was going to go off to this strange place called Thornfield.
Yeah.
And we sort of end with her on her, we start these new chunk of chapters with her on her way there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Do we want to say maybe some first impression things for like overall, or do we want to go kind of chronologically through the events?
I'm down for whatever. I like the idea of talking about kind of our gut impressions from it. I'm guessing you didn't really like it. You were sort of disappointed.
Wrong 100%. No, I absolutely loved this. What I want to say is my first kind of gut impression takeaway from this chunk of chapters is I am now shocked if I ever see an adaptation where someone decides to play Rochester as just really angry and shouty, mm-hmm. like we saw Sirian Hines do a lot. Because I'm like, clearly you didn't read the original source material. Or if you did, you went in with some weird prejudice or something, because when I was reading this, that is not at all how he came across to me. I think he seems rather cold and mysterious at times, but like there's a few exclamation points here and there, but never did he ever seem like he would, you know, scream at a woman on a road after he slipped on the ice. Like, so when they do that now, I'm like, weird, why did you do that?
It's very clear to me. It feels similar to some of the other things. Like we talked about the idea the last time we talked about it, where with Bessie, you have to pick between mm-hmm. showing her, you can't show the like multiple layers of her and the fact that she is simultaneously this light for Jane and this abuser, essentially, mm-hmm. and how it's really hard to be able to capture that in an adaptation. And I get the impression that there's a similar choice that's being made in a lot of these films where, because I was reading it with sort of that same initial gut reaction as you, where I'm like, what do they mean then? Why are they making him such a dick in all these adaptions when he's so clearly not? But it is, I was really carefully reading those moments and those mm-hmm. quotes around him. And I can see how you would choose to do that. But mm-hmm. this is why I think they're wrong. Mm-hmm. Because I agree with you and I think they're wrong. In Jane's head, which is obviously the only perspective that we get in this, we're reading this whole story from Jane's head. She acknowledges that he's being gruff or any of those things that you could interpret as him being like an angry, yelly man. I mean, he literally falls off the horse and swears, which we're going to talk about that a lot when we go through it chronologically. Jane is never uncomfortable about it. And I think that that is almost impossible to portray when you're having a large man yell at a smaller woman.
Yeah.
You're not going to be able to do that unless you can give that actress some additional layers of context for that.
That's a good point.
I really agree that even when they're doing something where I'm like, okay, maybe technically that's how it was written in that moment. Maybe you could interpret it as him yelling. It's not the feeling of it. And that's the one of the big things that we talk about in the idea of adaptation is what is the feeling of it? Are you using this different medium to tell the same story and capture the same feeling of that story?
Absolutely. Maybe on that note, then I can talk about one of these notes that I took when, you know, doing one of these deep reads of a Rochester and Jane scene. I think this passage that I'm going to refer to here specifically comes from when he is, quote unquote, talking like a sphinx. And I thought it was so interesting that, so these chapters are the first time we see Bronte writing rather long chunks of dialogue, where before everything was pretty short and to the point. And I think that's partially because that's how Jane's life was, you know, as everyone said what you needed to say, except unless your friend is dying and then she can tell you this beautiful soliloquy about death and God and all that stuff.
I was going to say, except for Helen, but yeah. Right.
So we have these big chunks where Rochester is monologuing and he's kind of talking to himself. He's kind of talking to Jane. And one thing that really struck me is with these long passages, we don't really have any contextual descriptions. She never kind of says she never like has that chunk and then says, oh, and he had this look on his face like he was sad, or she doesn't express, write his emotions down. It's all just simply in what he's saying. And what stood out to me with that is I think now you can see so clearly how different actors can come at this performance from so many different lens and viewpoints, because they don't have that sort of directorial note from the author of like, Rochester was mad, Rochester was sad, Rochester had his hands on his hips in an angry position. He mostly just talks. And then whatever you as the reader fill in with your imagination, kind of based on solely what he's saying, I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, I think the one particular example from that same sort of scene that you're talking about is that moment with Adele, because I think we talk a lot. So this is the very end of this chunk that we read. So I want to talk about this and then I'm sure we'll go back to the beginning. He's talking about Adele. Adele has come out wearing this dress that he got her, and she's so excited about it. And she's been playing with her present, and he has been watching her, which so sweet. So he's been talking to Jane, but he's been watching Adele sort of over Jane's shoulder, and he sees her go off with her dress and he knows she's coming back. And so he's like, we don't have to rush because Adele's going to come back in this dress. And he says those lines around, she charmed my English gold right out of my British pockets. I have been green too. And then he goes on and talks about how Adele is exactly like her mother, right? And we know from context and from other things, and we know that he goes in to explain a bit more about this later, the context of Adele's mother. And so actors can make the choice to put all that bitterness in that speech or not.
Right.
Yeah, I don't read this as Rochester being bitter. I read this as the way that you talk to a little kid when they're doing something full insane. Like my cousin has two little kids who I love more than anything. And every once in a while, they'll do something that's very like their mother. Mm-hmm. And it drove many people crazy. And her being really annoyed by it is so funny to me, because I'm like, this is 100%. It's hard to live with a tiny version of you, huh? And I'll do that. I'll say stuff like that to the kids where I'm like, oh yeah, you are exactly like your mom. And I'm saying it with this adoring tone of like, I love you. And it's a bit tongue in cheek and it's a bit sarcastic. And it's for my cousin in the room teasing her, but I make sure to keep my tone so that the kids don't read that as me teasing them.
Right.
And I read this as that's what he's doing. What he's saying is she charmed the English gold right out of my British pockets. But he's saying it like, you little girl wearing your fancy dress that I bought you because I knew you'd love it, and you look just like your mom who did do a con on me.
And then I shot her lover.
And it's fine.
No, I love that too. Yes. Of like, how do we read his tone? I made a note for another moment of him talking where I feel that he comes across to me as very sarcastic, but I read it in a charming way, I think, similarly. Mm-hmm. What I think is interesting, though, is when Adele returns into the room, that's kind of what breaks the spell, I think, mm-hmm. that he's kind of been in this trance of just sort of talking mysteriously about his past, sort of starting to allude to his feelings and plans toward Jane. And then when this child reenters the room, kind of a reminder of his past, you know, oops, remember last time you fell in love with the lady? This is what happened. Mm-hmm. And so then he shuts the evening down. And he's like, okay, you should take her to bed and I bid you ladies good night. And I think it's an interesting kind of end to that scene.
Yeah. And I think speaking of interpretations of people who we think maybe didn't understand Rochester. And then I really want to talk about her first impressions of Thornfield. So we'll jump just right back to the beginning of the section. But she talks a little bit at the beginning of this scene about him drinking at dinner. Yeah. Uh-huh. And so I agree with you. It feels a little bit like that breaking of the spell moment, but I don't see him as 57 drunk. Like,
yes.
Him as like, I'm going to trap you on the stairs drunk. I see him as that, like, you and a couple of friends split a bottle of wine at dinner. You did drink more than you thought you did. When you mm-hmm. go to stand up, you do that little, ooh, okay. Like, I don't see it as like he had a problem. I see it as like, suddenly you're hanging out with these new people and you're like, we're gonna be best friends forever. And I love you guys. And I just feel like what I really want to say to you is how much your friendship means to me. Like that, like you feel emotional and you start sort of like talking and people are like, okay. Like, mm-hmm. and so Adele coming back into the room makes him go, I think I might be a little
like, maybe I've had one too many.
Actually, you know what? This is a story that I'm going to save for a different day.
No, I love that too. Because like, again, these little things are so subtle, right? Because I think it is, it's Jane, like in her reflection of him, she thinks to herself that maybe he had like mm-hmm. some wine at dinner and that's why he's being like this. So yes, I love that. And I also read that that way too. It's something I kept thinking about when his talking became more bizarre. And I'm like, yeah, you definitely had some wine at dinner.
Yeah. And I definitely think he didn't cross a line because right, Jane is agreed. Like still comfortable. And oh, yeah. she would definitely be uncomfortable if he had been too drunk.
Right.
So zooming all the way back, this is Rochester obviously being interesting. He's got all of this energy, but when she's first introduced to Thornfield, I really, really loved her description of it and how quickly those first 3 months go. She falls into this routine there and she's so comfortable there. And I have a few things that I want to say about that, but what were your kind of like first takeaways from that introduction to Thornfield, the place the rest of our, well, the story we love takes place. There's other parts. The story we love takes place in Thornfield.
I like I said, I don't read as much as I watch television and movies. And so, and also I'm like, I do art in my free time. So visualizing things is a big thing for me. So when she was describing Thornfield, I was trying to create an image of it in my mind and like a map, a mental map of, you know, when she describes like going up the staircase and then there's like the corridor of rooms to one side and everything like that. And it was interesting to me, like having these other movies and sets in mind, there were some like elements of certain sets like that I thought of specifically, which I know the location that they used for a couple of the movies were all filmed at the same place. So there mm-hmm. are certain features that I've seen in the films and TV shows that just kind of stick in my mind when I think of Thornfield. But that was one thing for me, is kind of trying to map it out and get a sense for the size and like just kind of the vibe and the tone of it. But I enjoyed that a lot. I couldn't help but picture Dame Judi Dench. Dame Judi Dench, the hardest freaking name for us to say on this show. I couldn't help but picture her when I was picturing Mrs. Fairfax, although sometimes that would fluctuate. And that's another thing I actually really wanted to talk to you about is, how do you visualize Jane when you're reading her? Are you picturing any of the actresses or are you creating a new image of Jane in your mind?
So I don't think I'm quite as visual in the way that I read things as you. I visualize like particular moments sometimes, like when they're walking into a room and they're describing that room, I'll visualize a particular moment. But I almost, there's definitely moments where I can see like Jane and Rochester sitting by the fire in my mind's eye, but I more often picture myself as Jane.
Cute, Lillian.
Like, I more often am like in that first person perspective of like, I'm the one walking into the room, seeing it.
I'm
the one sitting next to the fire. And also I think deep down, wouldn't I be an amazing Jane Eyre? No, I totally wouldn't, because she's so very 18 in this book, and I cannot. I feel 1,000 years older than that, even though it's not that much older. I'm 28, but it feels 1,000 years older than her every time that I'm like, honey, what are you doing?
Lillian, you're still younger than the oldest actress who's played Jane, so you could do it. True. And you have beautiful brown hair, just like her. That's at least true. How I picture her. So yeah.
You just picture her exactly like me. That's what I want. When you read the book going forward, picture my little gob right there.
Lillian's reading the book and she's like, it's a me. Perfect. I was kind of, my brain was doing like a mashup of a couple of actresses that I thought worked for this, along with like just kind of filling in random blanks. I kept thinking of, because I really like little Anna Paquin, little Quaquin. From that version. So, and I also think the way that adult Anna Paquin looks, like I picture her in playing Rogue, like in the early X-Men movies. So that face was coming to my mind a lot. But yeah, no, I was just curious kind of what you were visualizing. So I love.
What a missed opportunity that they never had her play Jane as an adult, because she is almost 40 now, so she can't do it. But
she can play Fairfax.
That is how ageism works in Hollywood.
Yes, right. Exactly. Are you past 30? Okay, you're an old woman now.
You're almost 40. You're basically dead.
But going back to first impressions, one thing I felt was charming. So when we meet Adele, I liked that Bronte went back and forth between writing in French, and then she had like one section where she said this in French, and then the rest was written in English. But I think one thing that stood out to me from that is I love the way that she writes the rambly way that an excited child talks. Mm-hmm. Of just being like, oh, well, I lived here for a bit, and then Mr. Rochester came in and got me, and we were on this boat, and everyone was seasick, but he carried me across the gangplank, and just like keeps on talking, which by the way, the idea of him carrying her across the gangplank like touched my little heart, and I'm like, oh, what a good papa.
And the fact that they all got sick, and he's like annoyed by it, but he takes care of them. Like, what a dad. Dad move to just be like, I hate that everybody's sick. Come on, Sophie, let's go.
Yeah.
Come on, Sophie, I'll carry Adele. You just have to get yourself off the boat.
Oh my gosh, amazing. So those are some of the things that stood out to me from early Adele in those chapters.
For sure. I loved Adele. The version of the book that I have has all of the lines in French, but then it has the translation underneath. It's got a lot of endnotes. It's got a lot of footnotes. I really like the version of this book that I have. It's, in case anybody's curious, it's an old Barnes and Noble classics adaption that I got, or not adaption, version, whatever.
Your face just said, Lillian. It was just like little you standing by the cannon, just being like, what?
Oh, no. Okay. But yeah, I completely agree. I found Adele really like charming as a child. And I also, there were so many lines that like, I get it in the movies. I get why sometimes people will say mean things about Adele. Like in the movies, characters will say things that I'm like, no. And it's because they're saying the quiet part out loud, because she thinks all these things in her head. So she's like, Adele wasn't like particularly talented, but she also wasn't, she didn't have any quote unquote deficiencies, because that's how we talked about children then. And so she just was like a little kid. She's just a kid who needs to be taught. She's been overindulged. Mm-hmm. She needs to be taught to sit down and learn. And I love listening to how patient Jane is with that, and just how sweet all of these moments are between them, and how sweet her and Mrs. Fairfax's relationship is, and how sweet the whole house and the whole space of Thornfield is.
Yeah.
And the note that I wrote down as my like kind of initial impression of how she describes Thornfield during these months is the idea that it is both described as this like large space, but it also feels really cozy. And the spaces that they choose to spend the time in, and they choose to tell the story in, they walk through the larger rooms. You understand that it's this big old castle space, mm-hmm. but the spots that they live in, the spots that Jane chooses to spend her time in, because she could be anywhere in this big house, are the cozier warmer, more like casually furnished in a way. I think you remember my house growing up, we had the living room that we weren't supposed to sit in.
Exactly. Yes. Like,
it's not that. It's the one where you can sit in it. There's no bowl of decorative balls. It's just sort of like a true living space is where the story takes place. And I think that I find that interesting how much that was called out.
Yeah.
Because I have a feeling that some of the future characters, Blanche, may not appreciate those parts of the house quite as much.
Yeah. No, I love that. That observation, Lillian. I think that's beautiful. I would also feel like I kind of subconsciously picked up on that, but I'm glad that you just put words to it. So yes, awesome. It does feel like a very cozy place.
The last thing that I want to talk about Thornfield is those moments right before Mr. Rochester is introduced. And it's one of those things where I always struggle with the assumption that most of the people who read this book now, mm-hmm. The vast majority of them know he's coming. Mm-hmm. They know Rochester's on his way. And I don't know if that's how she wrote it, but we know it. And so I can't tell how much I'm like projecting of like all of these lines. I'm like, yeah, but then wouldn't it be great if like a crazy person showed up? He fell in love with you and he was like really charming and lovely and wonderful, but the laughter was explained. And she's towards the end of this sort of like quiet Thornfield chapter. She says this line that I think is so wonderfully Jane, where she's able to make anything livable and happy. And she is in a position where once again, she went from Gateshead, where she had all of this privilege and comfort, but she had no people to love. She had no life that was really worth living. She was constantly abused and all those things. And then she went to Lowood, where she had none of those comforts, but she had people who cared about her in Helen and in Miss Temple. And then she goes to Thornfield, and her initial introduction to Thornfield is there's kindness. There's people who are kind to her. Miss Fairfax is kind to her. Sophie is nice to her. Leah is kind to her. She feels very welcomed there. Her and Adele have this lovely blooming relationship, and she has a very comfortable life there. Mm-hmm. And very quickly, she says, the very privilege of security and ease that I was becoming incapable of appreciating. So within 3 months, she's bored.
Yeah.
And I just feel like that's so Jane.
Well, I love that she prefaces this confession of her boredom with her saying, like, maybe this will sound odd. Like, she knows. She's mm-hmm. like, how, like, ridiculous of me to still want more than this nice, happy place that I've found. I loved, yes, that kind of reflection for her. And I've recently, in my anxiousness to keep reading, but not being allowed to, not because you... But I'm trying to be good and not like read ahead without being able to talk about it smartly. I went back and watched some episodes from the 80s version, and it's her in those scenes like walking the roof and kind of like she's got her arms wrapped around like the castle turrets and she's just gazing at the horizon. And that's when Jane gives that passage, and I would have to look it up, but something about women need exertion just as much as men mm-hmm. do, and goes into that beautiful, very like feminist line that was great. So that all stood out to me as powerful and awesome. The thing that struck me when I was kind of doing my critical analysis of this was, so in that scene, she talks about walking back and forth on the third floor. And I presume the reason she does that is because she feels like she'll be out of the way from like the staff if they're working. So that way mm-hmm. she doesn't bother anyone. But she says that she's literally up there daydreaming. She's just kind of walking back and forth and like in her own little head, fantasizing places far away. And it's there where she starts feeling restless. And it's on the third floor where Bertha is kept, which I think is so interesting, where it's like Jane is feeling restless. Meanwhile, unbeknownst to her, there is a woman locked away in a singular room who's surely more trapped and restless than Jane can ever mm-hmm, imagine. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that I'm definitely doing while reading through this is kind of trying to like draw these parallels between Jane and Bertha, because I think there's something very interesting there. But that's, yeah, what really kind of stood out to me there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I did actually find the passage that you were referencing, because I also noted this down, and I also agree that the proximity to Bertha when this passage happens is so critical. And it starts with, women are supposed to be very calm generally, but women feel just as much as men feel. They need exertion for their faculties and a field for their efforts as much as their brothers do. They suffer from the rigid restraint to absolute stagnation previously as men would suffer. Precisely as men would suffer. And then she goes on to talk about how narrow-minded that privilege that men get to go out and see the world. And I think you're probably absolutely right. I completely missed it. And the 83, I did not feel like that was what we were getting from it. But I did see that moment in the way that they interpreted that in the 2011, when yes. Jane is looking out the window before she goes to post this letter and talks mm-hmm. about how she's, instead of talking in her head, she's saying it to Mrs. Fairfax and saying, I wish that women could do things. I wish that we could have those adventures. And I think that that also, it draws that parallel back to what we see right before she makes the choice to do this. The whole reason she's at Thornfield is boredom.
Yeah.
She wants an adventure in her life. And she's like, what is the only way I can get that? Mm-hmm. What's the only kind of things within the constraints of society that I can get that? I'll go get a job. Mm-hmm. I'll get a job as a governess. I'm qualified for that. I'll go somewhere else. And she finds this place has all the things that you're supposed to want. And I think that particularly as women, there's a list of things we're supposed to want. And they're supposed to make us happy. Mm-hmm. And we're supposed to be comfortable. And we're supposed to be wives. And we're supposed to be all of these things. And if you're not fulfilled by that, if you're not fulfilled by the small list of things women are supposed to want, this comfort and security and ease and people being nice to you and being in a place where you're cozy and a little mm-hmm. bit isolated, but who cares? Mm-hmm. Then there's something wrong with you and you're crazy and we should lock you in an attic.
Well, I was just going to say, I can't make this intelligent comparison until I've read specific chapters about Adele's mother and about Bertha. But mm-hmm. those are examples of women who defied that restraint, right? Mm-hmm. They're probably not bored because, I mean, one is a ballet like singer or dancer, and she's off like dancing on the stage and getting wooed by wealthy men and living a crazy life. And Bertha, who knows what she got up to before they decided she's insane, lock her away.
I think like, she's bored now.
Yeah, she's super bored now.
Unless she's playing movies for herself in her head, in which case she's probably fine.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and maybe just like in the 2006 version, he has a very nice apartment for her and she gets tea services and dress up.
Yeah.
And who knows? We'll find out. So Jane goes to post a letter and she goes on this long walk. And again, we get a big description of nature, which I loved. Mm-hmm. It also, I liked that she spends quite a good deal of time, at least it seemed to me, sitting on this hillside, enough time that the sun sets and the moon rises, just kind of looking out at things, probably still thinking about these journeys she wished she could take, journey on, if you will. But
there's like something there, you know? It's yeah, a 2011 seriously. Musical for those of you who don't, or 2013 musical for those of you who don't listen to every single episode of this podcast.
But right before our romantic lead shows up, she can hear his horse coming. She can like see the dog arrive first. And she brings to mind, again, we have instances of fairy tales and mm-hmm. folklore where she thinks of this creature called, and I believe it's pronounced the guy trash, which is like kind of what Rochester is. Just guy trash. Which you know how intentional that is.
I'm sorry for the weird noise I just made. A laugh was being physically stripped from my body as I tried to tamp it down because that's the funniest thing anyone's ever seen.
I think that's what it's called. It's just like the man who arrives. Oh my God, but it's supposed to be like a fairy creature that can sometimes be a horse or a great dog or whatever. And when she sees a man on its back, she's like, oh, it can't be the guy trash.
Because she first thinks it's the, she hears the noise and then she sees the dog and she thinks the dog and the noise are the creature.
Yes.
And I completely agree with you. It's this fairy tale setting. And it actually, I went back and reread this because I lost track of what was happening because she was both talking about the sun setting and describing the moon. And I was like, what's happening? And I realized it's that moment between during dusk when the moon has risen, but the sun is not quite set yet. Mm-hmm. And I can just see that light. And so many of the adaptions actually capture that sort of ethereal light and fairy tale foggy moment so well that she's indulging in that fantasy, right? Like she's sitting there indulging in that fantasy when some sort of fairy tale like thing comes upon her. And but she notices a man. Piper, continue.
She notices a man, and we now know for sure that if a version ever does where he like rears in front of her and then falls, they've done it wrong, because so in the text, he rides past her and then his horse slips on the ice and he falls and then she goes back to help him. So that is now, we have the facts. We know what's happening. So,
and he's not mad at her even a little bit at all. He's definitely mad about the situation and he makes a joke later about it, but he is not mad at this poor woman he finds in the street. He does. He does swear a lot to himself. And I pictured that moment when like you stub your toe and you're like, geez, like it almost is loud because it hurt you.
Yes.
And because Jane like comes up and is like, are you okay? And he like fully just keeps swearing about falling.
Which would be,
love it.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I wrote down, is that I said, he doesn't strike me as someone who's like shouty because he's angry, but he's probably just really in pain and frustrated and embarrassed. Like a horse fell on him and he landed on the cold, hard ground and his ankle is twisted. So yeah, it's like, oh, this hurts. I'm embarrassed. Oh no, there's a person here who saw me fall. Great. Like, and he's already,
if you've ever fallen as an adult, like if you've been walking and you fall as an adult and you do that moment of like, I think first of all, two things. One, I think I really hurt myself. Second of all, there are people here who can see me and I am supposed to be a grown-up.
Yes. It's like, don't cry. Don't cry.
just keep swearing. It's don't. And I can't even imagine you got that extra layer of I'm a man. I am, just keep swearing and it'll, and you won't cry and it'll be fine.
Yeah. Speaking of I'm a man, one thing that I really liked about, so Jane takes some time to kind of describe her initial impression of him in these scenes. And I think twice she talks about his masculinity, which I think is so interesting. And I think it's crucial to note that when we examine, you know, the romance of this 18-year-old girl who's spent her life mostly surrounded by women and children. Only man she really knew was like a douchebag of an old priest. And then also like one nice doctor, but she saw him for a second. So whatever. So yeah, now she's got this person here and she describes him as masculine and broad. And I liked the way she talked about him. And she says, if he was handsome, maybe I would have been too shy to talk to him, but he wasn't handsome. He was just kind of like a dude. And so therefore she's not in, what's the word I'm looking for? She's not intimidated. She's just like, oh, here's just a person who needs help and I can provide that. So I'm going to help. And so I thought all of that was very interesting.
Yeah. And she says that one of the lines in particular that she says, because there is this whole description of him as like sort of dark and broody a little bit. And she talks about his dark features and his heavy brow. And he was very clearly upset, but again, not upset at her. And she says, I had no fear of him, but a little shyness. And yeah. I think that that's a balance that I don't see struck in a lot of adaptions. I see a giant horse come and fall down and this man start yelling at her. And she's like, dude, chill. I didn't do anything. And instead it's this moment of empowerment that we've talked about, this idea that Jane is someone who isn't often the one doing the helping. Mm-hmm. She's not often in a position where that happens. And I love that this very first moment with Rochester is him fucking up and her being there to be able to go, what a uggo.
Like, what up, ugly man? Need a like, hand?
And she doesn't think he's ugly. She thinks he's very neutral looking, which I've talked about before. Like, most men I find really neutral looking. And then if they've got a personality that I enjoy, they become more and more handsome in my mind. And that's the vibe that I get from Jane. And she sees him and she's not intimidated by his yelling, because I think as someone who has been in an abusive situation, she probably knows the difference between somebody yelling and somebody being frightening.
That's a very good point.
You get a hyper awareness of that when you're in a situation of abuse. And so I think where I'm reading into it, that she's got a good kind of compass for that. Mm-hmm. And she sees Rochester fall and then she gets to help him.
Yeah.
And I love hearing her inner monologue about how empowering that moment is for her.
Yeah.
That he, this strong, broad man needs her help. Mm-hmm. And I find it lovely. And the fact that he immediately accepts it.
Yes.
It's like, he doesn't, that's why I think it's going to bother me forever when he yells at her. That's the true power of that moment.
Yeah.
He could yell at her. A lot of men would, but instead he accepts her help fairly graciously. Like mm-hmm. he's so frustrated. I wrote down so many lines around what he says. She describes him as rough. She describes him as this sort of like gruff man, but he's calm. He calms himself down. He calms the dog down. It's a stressful moment. She understands that it's a stressful moment. He says, thank you. No, to her when she first offers help.
Yeah.
And then she offers it again and he thinks about it and accepts her help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I
trust her to be able to do the helping too. Cause what her offer is I'll go get help. Mm-hmm. And he says, I think you can do it.
Yeah, no, it's great. That's such a good point. Oh my gosh. There's so much about this scene too. And so we have, yes, this sort of emotional trust, support, equality, all of these things. But then there's also this element too of initial physical intimacy, right? Because mm-hmm. when she can't steady the horse, it's too agitated. Mm-hmm. He makes, first of all, like a quirky little remark about like, you can't bring the mountain to Mohammed or whatever. And so then he does one of my favorite parts is where he's like, you know, excuse me, he says, I need to make use of you and like lean on you. And so here now, mm-hmm. not only has she met this like masculine, broad, manly man, but also now he's like very close against her and she's like touching him and helping him onto his horse, mm-hmm. which is also like how exciting. And when you already had that kind of mysticism in mind, like before this happened, right? Of her look, like we talked about the Twilight and she's wondering about fairies and creatures. Here comes a mysterious rider. She like interacts with him, helps him on his horse, and then he's gone. And it's like, wow, wouldn't you daydream about that? Like after that mm-hmm. happened, like that's, it's exciting. It's not a usual occurrence. So here's a bit of thrill right when she's been wishing, right, for adventure. Mm-hmm.
And I love that moment when he's asking her to get the horse, which I think it's so much of the way that he behaves makes sense in the book in a way that it doesn't always in the movie. Mm-hmm. but he goes, okay, as it turns out, I can't walk and it is a bad time. Like he tries to stand up and he's like, oh, crap. So he's like, can you go get the horse? And I love what she thinks in her head, which is, if I just saw a horse acting like that on the street, I probably wouldn't have done anything, but he seemed to think that I could do it. So maybe I can do it. Mm-hmm. And she goes and tries it, which again, like what a specific kind of strength that is to be like, well, if you think I can do it, I can probably do it. And then going up and trying it. And I love the moment when he's not mad. He's not mad about any of this. So she's not successful at getting the horse to calm down. She tries for a while. And I picture him sitting there for like a long time, like trying not to laugh.
Yeah. Just like smiling
as he sort of realizes that she doesn't know anything about horses.
Right.
And then tries to grab the bridle, can't do it. And he goes, okay, well, that didn't work. And that's exactly the laugh I just did, is the laugh that I picture him doing, which is like, I don't want to laugh at you. I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing mm-hmm. at the situation.
Yeah.
Some people aren't horse people, and it turns out you're one of them.
I am now picturing in my head a modern day version of this, and I would not actually do this if I was making this movie, but he is on a motorcycle and the motorcycle wipes out and he's like, hey, can you go get me my bike? And it weighs like 300 pounds and she tries to lift it. She's like, no, I can't lift your motorcycle. And he's like, okay, take me to my bike.
Oh, it's so good. Oh yeah. It's just, well, and when I think about it, speaking of the adaptions that didn't do it well, I think one that we had previously talked about how it maybe didn't do what other ones did and missed the mark. The 96 one with William Hurt, I think beat for beat what we just described. And I think it's much closer, which again is there's a few moments in this chunk that I've thought about that similar to what I referenced with the last chunk where it makes me realize that there's another layer to these adaptions of them being products of not only the book, but also each other.
Yes.
Because if you watch the adaptions, you would think that that's the way that it happens. And similarly, in these next moments, the number of adaptions that combine that first meeting in the near the fire when she's introduced to him as Mr. Rochester, and the next scene that happens multiple days later.
Yeah.
The number of adaptions that combine those into one conversation, there's no way that's not a product of the fact that you've seen so many adaptions that do that. And I just find that another really interesting layer to the way that we're, to the thing that we're doing that no sane person would do, which is watching so many adaptions of Jane.
Absolutely. No, I love that too. One last thing I wrote down before we move on to the next chunk is that I love that you mentioned that he says, thank you. He says, excuse me. And when he leaves, because he does that little question game when he hears her reference Thornfield, and he's like, oh, like, who's the master there? And she's like, Rochester. And he's like, do you know what he looks like? She's like, no. And he's like, okay, cool. It's like, well, anyway, you better hurry home. And like the line that I have here is, thank you. Make haste with your letter and return as fast as you can. Return, like he knows, he's like, I want you back at the house. I want to make sure you're safe. You're interesting. This has all been quite a way to meet my governess. Go post your letter and then come home. Like, I wish he said come home, but you know, we'll work our way up to that. But then the line that she says, kind of in my book, everything has been written in like a normal kind of novel format, but then there's like this two lines of poem that's kind of like centered in the middle right after he leaves. And I don't have the first one written down, but the second line is, the wild winds whirl away. And that's like how she reflects on his departure. And it's very interesting.
Completely. And I love the way that she describes like going to continue to post her letter. It feels very much like, I know she doesn't have a friend there, but the reader in so many ways is her friend that she's telling this story to. And it feels very much like I can imagine you and I at 18 and like you have some interaction with this guy who like fell off a horse. And then you guys had this very weird tension thing happening. And it was just like, and I'm just kind of like there also seeing it. And then we walk away and you're like blushing to yourself. And I'm like, what the hell was that? And you're like, it was nothing. Stop. Like, I don't like him. Shut up. He's not even that cute. Like, it's fine. Like, that's absolutely the energy of her being like, I definitely didn't think he was cute. And there was like no romance there. I just thought about him the whole way there, the whole way back. And then I kind of like stood around where I met him and like looked around at the fog. And but he like wasn't there anymore. And I was totally had a normal emotional reaction to that. And then I went home.
It's very cute. I agree. I love moments like this when, yes, we are reminded that she's 18, where sometimes in movies and shows, when they have a much older actress, you can forget that. But in the book here, there are little scenes when you're like, oh, this is so cute. We've all been there, right?
Yeah. We've all had crushes on guys that we just met. And we're like, I totally didn't picture our lives together in my head. I've known him for 2 seconds.
Yes, right.
Unfortunately for me, that has never turned into Mr. Rochester. So thanks, books, for lying to me.
Yeah, geez. Wow. False advertising.
And on that note, I'm done with Jane Eyre and I quit the podcast.
Lily, no. We have to talk about the first fireplace scene.
And the second one.
So my note about the first fireplace scene, because this is something that always strikes me, is when he has that line where he's asking her if she likes presents, because Adele, you know, has gotten her gift, or she is anticipating her present. And she's like, did you bring a, I hope I can say this right, cadeau before Miss Eyre, a present? And he's like, oh, are you expecting a present? Do you like presents, Miss Eyre? And like that question, I think it's so interesting how people deliver that line, how different Rochester actors do, because as we've kind of like sleuthed ourselves from many versions, I do firmly believe that gift giving is his love language. And not that that's something that he would like mentally think about, but this is like how he knows how to interact with people. But it's also how he knows that people typically interact with him. And I think that's another, it's like the first sort of like test, I think, that he gives Jane of kind of being like, every person in my life sees me for my wealth and my land and, you know, what I can give them or what they can take from me. And I think his asking her, it's like, do you like presents, Jane? It's the kind of him being like, are you like these other people? And then of course she gives the correct answer that he's looking for. And she's like, I don't know. They're often thought pleasant things. I haven't had one, but I think it would be good. Also, be specific, dude. What kind of a present are you talking about? Like, And thus starts their little banter. But that's what struck me, is his kind of like sussing her out there.
Totally. I completely agree. And I think one of the other moments within that that I love is they do immediately fall into this back and forth of this sarcasm that, as a very sarcastic person myself, I know how quickly you can have that like bonding of a kindred spirit of somebody who can be sarcastic with you. My most frequent experience of this is not in romantic situations, but instead of work situations where I'll start a new job and I'll start talking to a coworker and we'll just fall into this like sarcastic back and forth. And I was like, we are going to be shit talking in the break room together. Because you can immediately fall into that. And I think that the great additional layer of context that I think we see in some of the adaptions again, but not all of them, is how unique their conversation is by contextualizing it with Mrs. Fairfax there with her knitting. What a little bean. I love her so much. She's sitting there with her knitting and they're being sarcastic back and forth. And we've already established, Miss Fairfax has already said, like, I don't know, like sometimes he just like says stuff and you can't tell if he's serious or not. And Jane's like, oh, babe, it's called sarcasm.
Yeah, right. She's
and then so Miss Fairfax is there for this back and forth of theirs where they start talking about fairy creatures and he like accuses her of fairy creatures. And then she goes immediately into like, yeah, well, they actually left a while ago, which is like staying in the bit, right? Like he's making a joke and then she takes it just as seriously and responds back with the same tone, even though they both know they're joking. And Miss Fairfax is like, oh my God, these people believe in fairies.
Yeah, right.
Drops her knitting and is like so confused. I'm like, honey.
Well, what I loved about that too is Bronte would mention, she's like, every now and then Miss Fairfax would hear something that sounded familiar to her and she would jump back into the conversation. And dude, that is me when my friends talk about music that they like. I'll just be sitting there and they're talking about all these concerts and these albums and all these different things because my musical taste is very different from theirs. And then I'll be like, oh, folk music, Kenny Loggins, how about that guy, right? And they're like, yeah, okay, anyway, back to what we were saying. And I was like, okay,
is it bye. Sam and Maya?
And Grace.
And Grace, yes, right?
Our musical friends.
Sam and Maya and Grace sitting around talking about just, I do the exact same thing. It's Piper and I sitting in the corner. If we're both there, this is how I want you to imagine this is how the friend group works. If we're both there, they're talking about music. Piper and I are talking about romance.
Yes.
Neither group can participate. And I feel like it's the same thing. It's like Rochester and Jane are having this conversation that Miss Fairfax cannot participate in. And I just want Miss Fairfax to have another little old lady to talk about knitting with. Because knitting's a fine thing to talk about, Miss Fairfax.
Yeah, it's okay.
And I just adore her character in the book. I will say with 100% certainty, I'm going to make a strong call out now. Book Mrs. Fairfax knows nothing.
Oh, yeah.
She does not know about the lady in the attic. She takes everything at face value.
Yes.
And I think that that's such an excellent characterization. We've talked about this with all of the other side characters. Even though Mrs. Fairfax is simple, which I think is not, it's Rochester's word. It's not inaccurate. She's not two-dimensional.
Yeah.
She's just someone who takes things at face value. Mm-hmm. So when somebody tells her that you don't need to worry about the laughing in the attic, she goes, I guess I'm not going to worry about the laughing in the attic.
Yeah. It's probably just that weird lady that he hired to sew for us sometimes.
When like, she calls Grace Poole down and says, hey, not so much noise. That's not a secret code about keep the lady from laughing. It's her legitimately going, hey, that was a little loud. Can you not?
Lillian, I love you pointing that out because I had made notes earlier about, I think it's so interesting when Jane is initially trying to ascertain what Rochester's character is like by speaking with Miss Fairfax, you can really get Jane's frustration of every time she tries to like prod her for more information, she's like, but like, what movies does he like? Like, what does he laugh about? And she's like, well, he's tall with brown hair and he always pays his taxes. And you're like, come on, Fairfax, like, do more.
Every single paycheck that I've ever gotten has come right on the first.
Yes. Very prompt, a good landlord.
And you can just, another layer of that too, I think knowing Miss Fairfax character, and again, this is that like three-dimensional depth of this whole story, is even though we know that she's not Mr. Rochester's cup of tea, he still keeps her around because she deserves a nice place to be. And yeah. She's a widow who didn't have a lot of money and didn't have a position, which is a really vulnerable place to be in this time. Mm-hmm. And he still has her in the house. And he talks about the idea that he feels some level of responsibility for her because she is this very extended family, which she talks about the fact that she would never expect anything because of that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just another example of Adele and Mrs. Fairfax are the two main pillars of Thornfield that Rochester brought here to care for.
Yeah.
Adele is a child who maybe isn't his and was abandoned by her mother. And Mrs. Fairfax is a widow with no real claim to be there. And he makes sure that they both have a good life. And oh my God, I love this man.
Oh, Lillian, that I love that you pointed that out because I hadn't really thought about that. Now I'm very happy. A note that's kind of similar that I made of this scene is when he gives the gift to Adele, I think this is actually really sweet. So he like says out loud, he's like, I don't want to talk to you about it. So keep your noise down. But what I read here, so he doesn't want to talk about the present with Adele. It just doesn't interest him. But he understands that she's a little girl who is excited about this gift. And so he asks Fairfax to go and play with her. Mm-hmm. So he's like, I just can't be the one to like play with you right now. So like here, like I am going to make this connection for you two. You two go entertain each other. And so I love that. It's not just simply him like chucking a toy at her and being like, mm-hmm. get out of my sight. There's still levels of care.
Yeah, it's that second scene and he calls Mrs. Fairfax up specifically. So Adele and Jane have been called in to visit Mr. Rochester. Adele has been waiting for days for her presents to arrive because they were supposed to come with the other packages and they didn't. And where is her treasure? She keeps calling it a treasure, which I think is so cute. What a little kid thing to do. And then he brought her like a whole box. You know how like there's a certain age of a child where like you don't need to get them good stuff. You need to get them multiple things they can open because yes. they do not understand the value of each individual thing. Like if you got them one really nice thing, they'd be like, that was kind of boring. And this is very small. Like that's how Adele is. She's got a box full of treasures.
Cute.
And she's so excited about it, but he calls up Mrs. Fairfax. And I read that moment both as yes, how sweet he is to Adele. Mm-hmm. Yes, he's kind to Mrs. Fairfax, who he knows is bored. Like she's talked about the fact that she's bored in the winter. So being able to be there for Adele and to have something nice for Adele, that's a sweet thing to do for her too. Mm-hmm. And as I was reading this time, knowing that he was watching Adele over Jane's shoulder, yes, I think he wanted to be close to Jane, but I also think he positioned Jane's chair perfectly in the same way that like interviewers do with a clock over your shoulder so they can do that without being rude. Mm-hmm. I think he positioned her so he could watch Adele without looking away from her, which is so, so cute because he watches Adele open the present. His love language is presents. Charlotte specifically talked about love languages in 1847. And so he loves her. And so he's giving her these gifts and he wants to see her joy.
Yeah.
So he is giving up the joy of he's watching her open these presents. He's having that joy be separate from him. Well, these two people that he is caring for in this moment are enjoying their company over there because he wants to talk to the governess, who he explicitly he says, I totally forgot that you were here. And I'm like, no,
you didn't. No,
you did not. You orchestrated this whole moment. You crazy insecure man.
Because another scene, okay, so I skipped over and I'm sorry for jumping around, but I skipped over him talking about her art and asking her about piano and all that jazz. I don't think we need to spend 5 hours on that, but I do want to say, so before I dive into him talking about her portfolio, there is a moment when she's describing like the time that's passing between the first fireside scene and the second fireside scene and about how people came to the Thornfield to speak with Rochester. And she says she like overheard this at one point. He got her portfolio and he showed it to other people. And I'm like, dude, you have such a crush on this girl. You're like, oh my God, look at these really cool pictures that this girl I hired drew. Like she's so talented, right? Like he's showing it off to others.
You could just hear, can't you just hear that conversation of him like at dinner being like, you know what's cool about art is that my governess these drawings, and you can just see the like skeptical, okay, whatever faces.
Like,
and he's like, no, they're actually like super good. And then no one believes him. And he's like, no, I'm going to have them brought. Somebody go get Miss Ayers' pictures. You guys have got to see these.
It's so cute. I love it so much. The thing that I want to say, because I feel like I've spent so much time discussing like the importance of art for me personally and all this jazz. But what I love about the attention that Rochester pays when he's looking over her paintings and talking with her about them is that it shows us that he has spent some time like studying art. Like he understands technique and he knows what a quote unquote good piece of art is versus something that doesn't have skill or talent. And so I love that he's not just simply looking at these images at face value and seeing the aesthetic appeal. He's also noting the technique that must have been used and the study that went into the process. And he wonders about the story behind the images. So that like, there's a level of curiosity and depth that me myself as an artist hopes that people would have when they look at an image, not just be like, oh, it's pretty. And you're like, pretty? That's all you have to say? I spent 20 hours on this and you just think it's pretty? And he's like, no, how did you learn to do the wind? I'm like, oh my God, let me tell you. Thank you for asking. Like that level of detail and attention to that is beautiful.
I feel like the energy I bring to talking about your art is very Mrs. Fairfax of me. I come in and I'm like, this is so good. It looks like people. Am I right?
No worries, dude. I've learned like with Sam too. I'm like, okay, I legit, like I spell it out now. I'm like, if I'm actually looking for a critique or a serious conversation, I'm like, all right, serious time. Like, let's put on our thinking hats and just lay it all out. But anyway.
That's adorable. Yeah. I just, I absolutely love it. I love how he immediately like he's testing her, but he's testing her because he wants somebody to talk to. Mm-hmm. And I love so one of the big things that we sort of alluded to, but I wanted to talk about, especially considering the cap that we wear, which is thinking about the way that this story has been interpreted. I think it's so important that these moments are separate. Yes. I think that there's a story to be told where I get it. You've got to cut things down. You have to do something. You have to find ways to combine moments and tell the same story. But I think it's so important that he has the time. You can see that he's busy. You can see that he has all of these other things that he has to do. What a flimsy excuse that he didn't go to the meeting that night that all of his friends who came over for dinner were going to go to because it was chilly out. And not because he had 3 glasses of wine and was feeling really good and was like, you know, after looking at that art, I really want to talk to Jane and I want to see what she's up to. And I bet I could give Adele her present and Miss Fairfax would come sit with her. And then we could maybe sit by the fire and just like, Jack, I totally just want to talk to her. I don't want to kiss her face or anything like that.
And Lillian, as you described earlier, Thornfield has these cozy rooms, right? You just described him like wanting a night in with his family. All the members of his family and people that he cares about are all there. And he's like, I'm not going to go out to this meeting with the guys. I'm going to stay in by the fire with the lady that I like, the girl I'm taking care of, and the old woman that I'm supporting. Yeah. Just like, oh my God.
If he was any other man at the time, which like, I think this is a very clearly a feminist text, if the passage we read doesn't make that clear. And it's an 1847 feminist text, so it's within certain boundaries. But the idea that a man is more interested in choosing that group of company instead of the company of these other men who are going off to talk about the important things that men talk about. And the fact that he's instead choosing to have this deep intellectual conversation with someone he sees immediately, he's putting her as his equal. There's a particular passage that I had around that. So I am going to look for it.
Is it the one where he says out loud, he's like, I don't want to treat you as an inferior. Is it that one? Because that one's great.
No, I can't remember. So they're starting to have this conversation. He's several times told her to speak, which she does. My favorite response and the only rational response to it, which is about what, dude? Mm-hmm. And then she points out that they're paid support, that she's his paid subordinate. And he responds with a paid subordinate. What? and then they're talking back and forth. And he says, will you let me hector you a little? And she responds with, not because I'm your paid subordinate, but because you forgot. And then he responds back with, and will you consent to dispense with a great many conventions, formalities, and phrases without thinking that the omission arises from insolence. Mm-hmm. So it's this idea that I'm going to talk to you like we're peers, mm-hmm. and I'm not going to layer all this stuff in because mm-hmm. I don't really care to. Mm-hmm. Are you okay with me doing that? I still want to be respectful. I don't want you to think I'm being disrespectful, and immediately elevates her to a peer, right? Like that's what he's doing. If he just started talking to her very casually, given the constraints at the time, mm-hmm. it would be rude. It would be a disrespectful thing to do to her. That two sentences of, I'm going to talk to you casually is that okay with you? Mm-hmm. And immediately asking for her consent, which I'm obsessed with.
Because it's great.
It's so beautiful. It's so beautiful.
It is beautiful. I completely agree. You're right. He instantly sets the playing field. He's like, we are equals. And he doesn't just say it. He doesn't demand it. He asks her participation and permission. So yeah, it's beautiful. I've made notes about like when he first asks her to speak, it doesn't say anything. She just kind of smiles. And I'm like, she is so entertained by this. It's similar things that you were mentioning before. I'm just kind of like, I'm just kind of laughing, like not at you necessarily, but this is just so cute. This scenario that we found ourselves in. Well, it's also charming.
Yeah. It fully changed. Like, him being like, talk to me, like the three glasses of wine, I've decided three glasses of wine with dinner is how drunk Rochester is. Very so nice. He had food. So he's not like schwasty, mm-hmm. But he's just like, talk to me, Jane. That's how I would play it now and so her response is not to be uncomfortable and not to be like, oh my God, this guy is like so drunk. He's going to trap me on the stairs later. But instead to be like, I'm not going to respond to that. What do you want me to say, dude? You're my boss. Mm-hmm. And he's like, can you just be a person and I'll just be a person and then we can talk. And she's like, okay.
But then, so where my mind is going to, what I think is so interesting is the evolution of this conversation, right? Because it does start with him being like, I want to be equals. I just want to get to know you, blah, blah, blah. And they have that kind of toe-to-toe of, you know, he'll say something sarcastic and she'll say it back and he'll pose a question and she'll say something that surprises him or challenges him. Like, I love the line when she's talking about, one thing, no person freeborn would submit to. And he's like, anybody freeborn or not would do anything for a salary. Cause that's his understanding of the world. Mm-hmm. Is that people just want money and they will do whatever to get it. But he says, he's like, though your statement was wrong, I do applaud you for your answer. Like not one in like 10,000 governesses. And I'm paraphrasing here. I'm not reading off of this.
3,000, but close.
Yes. Would like have answered the way that you've done. And so he's seeing the level of her depth of like her wit and everything. And it's kind of at this point in the evening when he starts his Sphinx kind of monologues of like starting to talk in riddles. And I love how at first she keeps up with him, but then of course, cause he's being so vague and secretive. Mm-hmm. She says later on, she's like, to be honest, you lost me. I was with you for a second there, but now whoosh, right over my head. I'm not quite sure what you're doing anymore. But it's in those passages, you know, when he starts to kind of, we know now that he's comfortable in her presence. He obviously has a little bit of liquid courage and he's kind of unwinding and he's saying these kind of like deep, like philosophical, personal things. One of the notes that I wrote down here is when he's kind of doing this combination or comparison between happiness and pleasure, because I think in his mind, he's thinking about like happiness is what I should have had if my life with a married woman worked out the way it should have, but I can't have that anymore. And so therefore instead I will seek out pleasure, which is like happiness with an evil mustache. And I was like, that's an interesting, like these interesting comparisons. Like one is innocent and without harm and one has like perhaps bad intentions behind it, but he's kind of like weighing this on a personal scale in front of Jane. And she's like, what?
but we know that Jane loves these kinds of conversations, right? Yes. Like this is the conversation that she values above everything else because she has love. We think about Helen, right? Like those are the conversations she had with Helen. Those are the conversations she had with Miss Temple.
Yeah.
The conversations that she had with her other friend, Mary, can't remember her name. Other girl from Wellwood.
Girl who sat on a rock.
Those seem lovely, right? But she doesn't value those as much. She didn't value them then, and she doesn't value them in hindsight. The conversations she values are the ones where they're talking about things that are so real and so deep. And that's what he's doing. So even though she can't really keep up with him and doesn't know exactly what he's talking about, she A, doesn't push him to reveal exactly what it is. And B, challenges him on all of those beliefs. And Rochester responds by taking her seriously and accepting the premise of what she's saying and defending his hypothetical, which we know is his own, like, as a reader, knowing what we know, he's talking about wanting to court his governess, even though his wife is in the attic. and I think a passage that is so parallel to what you're talking about with the happiness and happiness with an evil mustache is, I think a moment that we see in some of the adaptions, I remember it most in the 2006, the idea of him talking about how at 18, he was her equal. And how at this, when they were the same age, they could have been something more equal to each other. And I think it's so heartbreaking to think about these two and how lovely their life would have been if they had met each other at the same phase in their lives with it's lovely that they find each other in the end, but with so much suffering between there and now. But he says this lovely line that I think characterizes Rochester and who he wishes he was capable of being. Which is, nature meant me to be, on a whole, a good man, Miss Eyre, one of the better end. And you will see that I am not so. So it's so clear that he doesn't think he's a good person. And how sad. And how, even though Jane is arguing with him that he should be doing things that are good, she also makes the assumption that he's capable of being good. And he has very clearly assumed that he is not capable of being that. And to have someone who sees you as this person who's capable of good and capable of being kind and generous and all these things that we can see in these few chapters. He is those things.
Which, Lillian, that kind of is a beautiful parallel to what you said earlier about their first meeting, where he says to Jane, like, essentially, you're strong enough, you can go and get that animal. And she says to him, it's like, you're good enough, you can make the right choice. But he's like, but I don't want to make the right choice. I want to kiss you all night long.
So I think what a great book. We did it. It's a good story. These two cuties found each other and they kissed and stuff, and then happy at the end, right?
Leading into how he's not a good person. So the part that I wrote down that I thought was like very exciting too is when he really starts to get out there and he's speaking again of angels and all kinds of other things. So that's risen now twice in this story. But what I kind of like was musing on is I feel like he, where before, you know, I said he was kind of weighing this personal scale in front of her. I think he's asking himself, he's like, is Jane my salvation? Because she's offering all this good advice, right? Saying all these good things to, like, if he followed her advice, he would be a better man. Or is she his temptation? Because this is the woman that he wants to smooch and, like, be, like, bad with.
I want to be bad with you.
Ooh, I want to be bad Mr. with Rochester. You. There's, in the Broadway musical, there's a song called Sirens, and I can't wait for us to talk about that musical because I've been thinking about it the whole time I was leading the scene. It's like so edgy and dramatic and I just love it. And it's very much this kind of discussion. It's like, oh, she could save me, but if she does, then I'm turning to the dark side and like all this good stuff. It's great.
I'm excited as well. speaking of things we're excited about, I realize that we done it again. And we've been talking for a very long time about Jane Eyre because it turns out we love it.
We do.
So I've gotten my stuff out. Are there any last pieces that you want to talk through with our beautiful listeners?
I've pretty much said everything that I needed to say. So yeah.
Okay, great. Well, for those of you, cause I do know that we've got at least one amazing listener who's reading along with us. our next chunk, I was wrong last time, which I know we corrected on the last episode because we haven't recorded it yet, but I definitely will correct it on the episode that comes out before this one.
That's time travel, folks.
Do you want to talk about some timey-wimey stuff? I'm about to get real timey-wimey with you. Doctor Who reference for those of you who don't watch that show. but we are going to be, the next chunk that we're reading is going to be chapters 15 through 20. We did not read to chapter 24 because that would have been wild. That would have been so much, which mm-hmm. is what I said at the end of our last book episode. So we're going to read to chapters through to chapter 24. Mm-hmm. Oh God, is that right?
You're the one who divided the book and who has the notes in front of you. I'm just who smiling has a and book nodding. With
Roman numerals. And apparently what I didn't know about me is that I am not good at reading Roman numerals. No, so we are reading through chapter 20.
Okay.
This is, I'm going to have Piper look at it on the camera.
Okay. Hold and down a little to the side. Yep. That is 21.
Yeah. So we're reading to chapter 21. We're okay. reading through chapter 20.
I love this process.
This is going on. I haven't done this yet, but I did start building a page on our website that will have what we read and what chunks, and it'll be great. And everybody's going to love it. And I'm not going to seem insane anymore.
Amazing.
Anyway.
just remember, Lillian, a V is 5 and X is 10.
Yes. But then they switch which side it's on is plus or minus. That mm-hmm. was what messed me up last time. Anyway. Mm-hmm.
but yeah,
so that is going to be coming out at the end of July. So you've got quite a bit of time since it is now the end of June. So you've got right about 4 weeks. So plenty of time. You can read about a chapter a week for those of you who need me to pace that for you. But,
what are we listening to? What are we watching next, Lillian?
We've done so much Jane Eyre. I can't even, why? I feel like I expect every story to have a lady in an attic. I expect every man to try to run me down with a horse. I feel like I don't know what love is if you're not trying to commit bigamy for me. So I think I might need some help to get those subtle Jane Eyre notes back.
Amazing. Amazing. Gotta watch something, you know, do a little swish and spit. And
gross.
What we're going to do to help Lillian with this problem of getting that Jane Eyre taste out of her mouth is we're going to watch a beloved story, called Little Women. And I am absolutely in love with the one from the 90s. And Lillian is a big fan of the new one from what year did that come out?
2019,
right before the pandemic. Hey. So we're going to watch both and we're going to talk about the story in general. We're going to talk about both versions, pluses and minuses of each. It's going to be
a lot of Piper saying that the 94 version might be the only one in existence.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And that anyone else is wrong. This is the Little Women 1994 version is a movie that I associate so deeply with Piper.
Yay.
It is a movie that I watched for the first time with her. And honestly, I think the last time I watched it was also with her.
Amazing.
So I haven't watched that in a very long time. But I watched the scene of Amy, taking off her, or talking about what it is to be a woman and what marriage is for a woman, in the 2019 version. Every day.
Nice. Very nice.
So,
well, we can have a little quote off because I have so many passages from the 90 version memorized that I say aloud to myself constantly.
In classic Air Buds fashion, I haven't read this book. Have you read Little Women, the book?
When I said passage, I am referring to the biblical text of the movie because it is so sacred to me that when I say passage, I mean scene.
we're movie people, guys. That's why do you think we're so shocked? The book is amazing.
I know.
Everyone
right?
else knew that. This is brand new news to us.
Wow, you're like 100 some years late, but welcome to the group.
Almost anyway. 200 years. Isn't that crazy to think about?
That's amazing. I love it. So we're watching Little Women. Check it out. I know it's currently on Netflix in the United States. So if you want to watch it with us, fabulous. At least the 90s one is. But yeah, that's what we're talking about. So until then, happy Jane Eyre reading and watching. We love you guys. Stay safe.
Bye.
Bye.
Stay safe.